This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thanks for your company on the Country Hour today. My name is Megan Hughes. This afternoon, I'm going to be focusing on the wild weather Queensland has seen this week. Strong winds lashed the Southern Downs region late yesterday, and across the weekend, giant hailstones fell, causing major damage and even injuries to several people. If you were caught up in the storms, what's it like at your place today, and how much rain did you end up getting? You can send me a text on 0487 993 222. Some local growers have seen their entire winter crops wiped out by the fierce winds and hail. Agronomist and farmer Kate Shooter tells Brandon Long the destruction is unlike anything she or her clients have ever seen.
I've seen a lot of poor weather on Saturday from lunchtime into the afternoon. Really large hailstones from golf balls to, in some places, cricket balls. And it's done a lot of crop damage, from probably 50% in some areas to 100% write-off in others.
Which areas are we talking about across the Downs?
That's what I can't believe. It's such a wide area, from Hendon to Talgai, Clifton, Headington Hill, Ascot, Manapouri, all through that area.
Have you seen some of this for yourself, or just been having phone calls at the moment?
No, I've been across it and seen it. It's something I've never seen before. Some of these crops that are 100% don't have a single stalk still standing.
And how are those farmers coping with that?
A lot of them are taking it well. Like, it's an act of nature that you can't change. So no matter how disappointed, you can't go back and change it. So a lot of them have a pretty good attitude like that.
And what crops are we talking? Mainly wheat and barley?
Yeah, mostly wheat and barley, with a handful of chickpeas.
How far off were they from being harvested?
Most of the barley was being harvested as it was coming in, and the wheat probably was about 2 weeks off in most cases.
Are you a grower yourself?
Yes, I work as part of a family farm here in Talgai.
How did they fare?
We're probably on the luckier end, anywhere from 50% damage to maybe 100%, which I thought was pretty bad on the Saturday till I got around with some clients and saw how bad it is further out.
And I'd imagine a lot of these crops wouldn't have any insurance.
No, maybe 50%. The cost of insurance in here is quite expensive, so not all growers take it out.
What's the next step then? Where do we go from here?
It's just continue on like every other day with plans for summer crop moving forward. There's not much else we can do about it. Some of them may double crop, but it depends how hard the ground's been made from that driving rain and hail, as to what they'll do next.
I'd imagine a lot of your clients would be multi-generational families. Are there any older generations who have seen this sort of thing before?
Some of the grandpas are in their 80s and have never seen damage quite this bad or quite as widespread.
I'd imagine things would still be a bit raw.
Yeah, I think it would be, because we're not just looking at crop damage. We're looking at, most of these growers have had their roofs of everything on their properties damaged. Some have damage to their houses. So, yeah, it's not good today, but they'll move on, I'm sure.
Agronomist and farmer Kate Shooter. Meanwhile, in other parts of the Downs, growers desperately need rain for the summer crop. Brendan Taylor is the grains president at AgForce and a Warra grower, and says their soil moisture is the lowest in 3 years.
I guess it's just, yeah, it's the same old this time of year with harvest coming into storm season. The risk of getting some curly storms is always real, and unfortunately Mother Nature reminded us over the last few days that, yeah, when she gets cranky, she can turn it on. And, yeah, there's been some crops completely wiped out in that south of Toowoomba and on other pockets over through the Burnett, have South Burnett and into the Brisbane Valley, seen some tremendous hailstorms, which is devastating. Yes, we can get crop insurance if we're prepared to pay for it, but crop insurance is very expensive if you're prepared to pay for it.
And around your region, most of the winter crop is off, is that right?
Yeah, we finished yesterday. Not sure the good luck or good management, but we've had a few rain interruptions, but just little ones, just nuisance value really. 5 mil here, 5 mil there, just enough to stop us for a day or two. But there's been an odd bigger fall amongst it. But yeah, we're at the time of year now where there was around my part of the world and back towards Dalby and west a little quite a bit of summer crop planted. So sorghum was planted early, and most of it has had very little rain since it's planted, and some of it's sort of been struggling along, and some of it's been growing remarkably well considering it's probably had 20 mils, 25 mils of rain at best up until the last few days in bits and pieces. We haven't had a double-digit rainfall event since the middle of August. It is very, very dry, and I would say we're probably the driest we've been at our farm for probably soil moisture-wise, probably the driest we've been for 3 years at this point in time. Cracks in the ground are enormous in anywhere there's been crops grown. But that being said, the winter crop harvest for us and many others has been very, very good. Been substantial yields, both wheat, barley. Barley's been probably the big one, with some incredible yields coming out of the barley. Wheat's been pretty solid generally, and chickpeas as well. We need rain now for the summer crop. So anyone that has managed to get under a good fall of rain and got a summer crop planted, we've got a foot in both camps, if you like. The winter crop almost off for a lot of people, or people are finished, but they're looking to the sky to get the summer started or progress what they've already started.
Are we seeing mostly sorghum, cotton, mung beans?
There's been an odd pocket around that's got a good fall of rain in the last couple of weeks, which will stimulate more planting of sorghum, I'd suggest. But we're not far from December now, and that's your prime mung bean planting window, sort of second half of December into the second half of January is your ideal mung bean planting window. And mung beans are the shining light from a dollar point of view, whereas everything else has fallen out of bed, particularly chickpeas. But mung beans look like they're going to trade pretty strongly next year. So I suspect we'll see a good mung bean area planted, providing we get the rain needed. And places that are really dry, they'll be looking at 40, 50 mils of solid rain to get that happening.
Brendan Taylor, Grains President at AgForce, ending that report from Brandon Long. What's it like at your place? Did you get under any of these storms, or are you still waiting for the rain to fall this year? You can send me a text on 0487 993 222. So across the state, in many parts of Queensland, farmers are still counting the cost of recent destructive storms. At Farnsfield, south of Bundaberg, a supercell has caused millions of dollars worth of damage. Sugarcane and macadamia grower Tony Russo says he was finishing harvesting last Thursday when he saw the storm brewing.
When I got home, then I received a phone call from my son just saying, Dad, we've been hit up here with what was just like cyclonic conditions with torrential rain, and we had sustained some damage. The extent of that damage wasn't realised until the light of day next morning.
What was the extent of the damage?
We got a ute that's damaged that we put in a shed because we thought putting in the shed would be the safest place, but unfortunately the roller doors and tin and debris have hit that ute and can cause considerable damage. We've got a lateral irrigator that's been tipped upside down. We've got a centre pivot that's broken off the last span and a half. We've lost three sheds that have gone in the storm, and potentially looking at somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 trees. Some have been irreparably damaged, some will be salvageable. We went through the orchard extensively over the weekend, pruning and standing those trees back up, and hopefully they'll recover, but that'll be a, you know, some time, maybe up to a month, before we see if they're going to reshoot and be financially available to keep that tree in the ground.
Speaking of finances, this must be a very expensive storm.
Just doing rough estimates before making any insurance claims. Plus, there was two houses that copped damage with roofs and water damage, just roughly anywhere between $1 million and $1.5 million before any insurance claims are made to fix sheds and irrigators and utes and so on. Plus, we've had severe wash through some of the farm because the rain was just absolutely torrential.
When I was out there last week, I saw there's some damage to the sugar cane. How extensive is that damage?
Well, look, the standing cane is fine. It's gone over. There may be some breakage there. I guess through our strip is where the plant cane is. And some of that plant cane, as you can imagine, it's only very young. It's very fragile. Some of it's been filled in and smothered before it's had a chance to establish a root system. A lot of wash in some of that area, but basically the plant cane has suffered more than what the standing cane has.
So the standing cane, that's still fine to get harvested?
Yeah. Look, given the right conditions, there may be some losses, but I can't imagine there being big losses in that unless that cane was actually broken off. But the cane that I've looked through of mine that's on the ground, it's just blown over. It's not broken off, so I suspect that weather permitting, and when that clears, we should be okay to harvest that, and it shouldn't be a great deal of loss in that.
That's good, because when we spoke last week, you also said we're about 70% of the way through the crush, so might have some delays from this wet weather, but overall you're not thinking it'll be too detrimental?
Well, we might need the caterers to come in and cater for Christmas lunch in the paddock, but we've got to remain optimistic. Who knows how long the storm season will last for, or who knows how long this event will last for. We may get a good run. We may get 2 or 3 weeks and make some inroads into the remaining of the crop. Then again, we may see a continuation of the pattern of these storms, but I guess it's just in the lap of the weather gods now as to how the rest of the season plays out, Tyler. But at this stage, it looks like going very, very close to Christmas, or if not beyond Christmas.
Did you have more rain or storm activity Friday and into the weekend?
Yeah, we did. We had some 40, 50 mil of rain on Saturday, so that's taken it up since the rainfall event. We're just on 100 millimetres as of today.
You had the Primary Industries Minister up here on the weekend. We've also got that disaster impact survey open. Are you hopeful that some government assistance will be coming your way?
Certainly, Atala. We'd like to thank, and I've got to thank the Minister for coming up. He drove up on Saturday from Gympie. He drove up here, and Steve Bennett for organising it. He was quite good. He was quite sympathetic to the damage that we've had, and gave us an assurance that he will be doing his best to help us out, whether that be through the assistance of recovery grants or whatever he can do, obviously with the help of the federal government, which we need. He said he will endeavour to do his best for us. And the politicians, so you can only take him on face value, but he came up here and we've got to thank him for that.
Sugarcane and macadamia grower Tony Russo. Now, the Department of Primary Industries has opened a disaster impact survey for storm-affected producers so they can apply for funding. So far, the department has received responses from 9 growers in the Farnsfield area.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Keeping with the weather across the state, a heat wave has been tearing through northern Queensland over the past week. And up on the Atherton Tablelands, both farmers and livestock are feeling it. On James Geraghty's dairy farm in Millamilla, the temperatures have been hitting above 30 degrees each day, and cows are certainly reacting. He says the heat has impacted milk production, with the total number of daily litres down by about 20% on his farm.
The grass is growing, that's the positive, but now the grass is too long, there's too much fibre in the grass, so the milk production's dropping. It's too warm, so the cows don't want to eat as much. so the production's dropping. It's just a time of year thing. If you look around, you'll see where we've been mowing the paddocks, trying to get the grass to be the right stage of growth for the cows to produce optimum milk. But yeah, that's tougher than it sounds.
By how much less are they producing?
Probably down between 10 and 15% now and dropping.
Is this typical behaviour at end of October, start of November for the cows?
No, the heat's probably a bit early this year. It's not welcome, but it's if we can just jag some lower temperatures, it only has to be like 3 degrees lower and it'll be fine. But that's all it needs to be. But yeah, this is just too hot, too humid, and we missed the rain. So out of all the rain, we picked up 5 mils over 5 days. And this country dries out really, really quickly. So yeah, we're doing okay, but yeah, we just like a bit more rain.
Meanwhile, down the road, they've got full hailstorms.
Yep, they can keep the hailstorms. We just want the rain.
And so can you go into a little bit more detail about how that grass growth does impact milk production?
Yeah, like if you look at the paddocks here, it's all got seed head on it. You don't want seed head on it. You just want leaf and not as much of the stem. So we just deliberately will shorten our rotations, try to keep the paddocks down. I know it sounds funny, but we'll actually go and fertilise to put some more nutrient in the pastures and maximise the return off those pastures and maximise the growth. And we'll bring other cattle in from the outside and use that grass and get it back to the right levels. Yeah, look, it's unless you can actually see what we're talking about, it's really hard to understand. But yeah, it's just there's too much fibre in the grass at the moment.
And how does that interfere with milk production, that fibre?
The cow can't eat as much, can't digest as much, takes longer to go through her, so therefore she just can't eat as much next time, and that just lowers her intake and lowers her production. Yeah, it's just too hot. The cows are, and you know, we've got the sprinklers on the cows at 4:15 in the morning just trying to cool it down because all the cows come under the roof and it just heats up so much. So you just, if you don't cool them down, it is a cumulative effect on the cows, and yeah.
So it's a bit of a combination of factors. It's the amount of fibre in their feed, how hot the cows are themselves, and that all plays into how well they produce their milk.
Yep, absolutely. So one of the blokes used to dairy 3 kilometres that way. He went to Victoria, took his better cows with him. I spoke to him a couple of years later and he said, you know, I've always read about these cows that give 8 and 10,000 litres and 12,000 litres. He said, now I'm milking them. And they're the same cows we had at Millamilla. They're just in a different climate, on different pasture, and they are producing 8, 10, 12,000 litres where they did produce 6 to 8,000 litres.
How many are yours producing at the moment and how much do they usually produce?
They're doing 21.5 litres a cow at the moment. That's probably down 3 litres a cow a day. Yep. And yeah, look, I mean, with the heat, that's what you expect.
Millamilla dairy farmer James Geraghty speaking with Sophie Johnson. Meanwhile, in Malanda, just 20 kilometres away, farmers were hit with unusual storms last week at Rachel English's dairy farm in the area. This, along with the heat, has presented another challenge, mud.
Pretty crazy, really. We've had extreme heat that has been very difficult on the cows and the workers. And then very, very wild storms in the afternoon. We've had a fair bit of rain. We were very lucky without getting too much hail. We were on the outskirts, but we got a little bit. But yeah, it has just been absolutely crazy, especially for this time of year. We usually don't get any rain at all out where we are. So the rain has been good, but it's been some crazy weather for sure.
Has that had any impact on dairy production?
Touch wood, our milk production has been fairly steady. So we haven't seen any major decreases lately. But it is very difficult on the cows, that extreme heat and then all the rain, which makes all the mud and that. The production has been good, but if it continues this hot, we will have definitely a drop in our milk production.
And so talk me through that mud situation. Why is that bad for the cows?
So when it gets really muddy, the cows like to go sit in the mud because it's hot. And with cows sitting in the mud, A, they get really dirty, so you have to wash them all before milking, which adds on a lot of time when you're washing 260 cows before milking. And then it also increases the risk of mastitis and udder infections and a higher cell count, all which can be demerit points and lower production and just not good for your milk at all. So mud is really not good.
And are your cows kind of behaving in that way at the moment?
Yes, some of them, we have some cows that love to go sit in the mud first up in the morning and just sit there all day, and other cows are a bit tougher and not going into the mud as much. But yeah, if the weather continues, it will get worse and more cows will be sitting in the mud all day.
How many mils did you get last week?
I think on Tuesday we had just over 20 mils in one big storm. And then on Wednesday, we had 25 mils plus a little bit of hail. Like, they're very quick, fast storms, so it's a lot of rain in a very short amount of time. The grass is looking really, really good, but it's just very unusual for this time of year.
When do you usually expect to see this sort of weather happen?
Usually around, like, very late November, start of December. So, yeah, it's a month, nearly 6 weeks early. So it's a little bit unusual, but wait and see what the wet season is like this year. It could be interesting.
Melanda Dairy Farmer Rachel English speaking with Sophie Johnson. Had a text come through on the Country Hour from Dorothy from Yarraman. She said, "Hello, Country Hour. Might just made of having solar panels, and along comes the hail." That is very true. There has been a number of solar panels damaged, especially in that sort of southern Queensland area. And actually, an ABC reporter has done a story on this and what you can do if your solar panels have been damaged. So if that is the case, you can head along to the ABC News website, which is abc.net.au/news. So you can learn what to do if you suspect that there is damage to your solar panels. It is coming up to 12:30. Up next, the latest on the changes to the Bureau of Meteorology's website. And then afterwards, I'll bring you the latest in the weather forecast.
Before the sun rises, your local ABC team are starting their day getting ready to help you start yours. Join us for local news and community happenings. ABC Breakfast, weekday mornings on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
The Bureau of Meteorology has made some changes to the colour of the radar and flagged that more changes are on the way as the backlash continues from its website upgrade. Many users have used the old or legacy website, but there are concerns over how much longer it will remain active, and others are worried about the cost involved in developing this controversial new site. Warwick Long spoke to General Manager of Environmental Prediction Services at the Bureau, Matt Colopi, and started by getting the details of the new radar.
The key change was really to move the default. So you could already on the display on the new website find the radar reflectivity, often referred to as the DBZ. But the default was actually set to what you call the rainfall rate in millimetres per hour, which was what is on our app at the moment. So we had that common sort of display between the app and the new website. But after a lot of community feedback and people being familiar with the display that is reflectivity, we actually changed that default. So you could already find it there, but we changed the default.
So the colour rate was what changed, but you've gone from one setting to the other.
The display is slightly different. So the colours are fairly similar, and you can see the sort of legend there that tells you from sort of light rain through to moderate and heavy rain. The difference is in a rainfall rate, millimetres per hour, it on occasions won't pick up the really intense reflectivity echo. So for example, if you've got hail in a massive thunderstorm, that hail will spike really strong reflectivity values, and it'll show those colours in that red or even black end of that sort of really strong reflectivity. Now, of course, if it's hailing, is really significant for severe weather, but it doesn't actually show up as rainfall because it is literally hail and solid water. So it's a slightly different way of looking at the radar, but the community feedback was really strong on that people wanted to see that reflectivity or that DBZ scale and display, so we changed that back on Friday.
So is this latest change, and there's been a few others in terms of what you can see when you get onto the main website and where the links are, etc. Is it an admission that things weren't right, that some of these changes were mishandled by the Bureau?
I think you've seen over the past 18 months or so, 15 months in fact, we've had a beta available in the public domain so people can test it. We've had sort of initial focus groups of over 2,000 people doing that testing. And then as it was in beta, we had over 700 different specific sort of users that were giving us feedback. But the reality is you take all that in, you've got it online for people to look at in advance. But as you go public and you see 2 million people looking at that site, every day, you're always going to get additional feedback, and we're basically responding to that. So yes, it is an admission that we've got additional feedback now as it's gone public, as it's gone live, and we're responding.
Does it cost money every time you make a change like this since the new website has been up?
This one with the radar, et cetera, was one that our internal the IT teams, the data and sort of digital teams that we have could do. So those people, you know, obviously have a range of duties to do, but there's no specific additional cost on that.
Other changes expected to happen to this website now? Obviously, you've made this change here on the radar. There's been an enormous amount of feedback over multiple amounts of different parts of that website. So is more expected here?
I think the key is there are certain specific feedback points, like how we display locations and the map itself and so on. And some of the things like seeing the radar kind of coverage map, which I think people gave. So those specific feedback points are certainly things that we can incorporate into the sort of future releases as we continue to upgrade and update the website. And then there are other things where we just need to really explain and work, probably do a better job of working through and explaining the different navigation features and the advantages and the differences between the old website and the new website.
Criticisms we've been getting quite extensively, the radar information becoming more vague, a lot of the data being washed out of the site, one example being fire danger ratings. Now, you still have the high, moderate and extreme, but the actual number used to be displayed next to that so people could to delve into just how bad that fire danger rating is. That's not there anymore. And other stuff, as you've just alluded to, being hard to find. So in terms of that scale of feedback, you know, are some things going to be looked at and others just being thought of as the public needs to learn?
I think just addressing the fire danger behaviour index up front, that one is going to be changed. So we are looking and working with the emergency management authorities, the fire authorities, like CFA, to actually update that, not just for Victoria, but for the country. So that one, that specific one, will be addressed. And in terms of, again, just working through and saying, well, there's some things that have changed and the data's still there, but it's just displayed differently. So that will take time to get used to, and we do need to do a better job of really explaining that. And I think a lot of our sort of YouTube and other video and Facebook releases are working through some of that.
What about making it easier just to see multi-day views of forecasts where it used to be on one page for a region or a town, and now you've got to click through? Are considerations being made there?
That is a really good one, because some of the feedback and when we got where the design was, people just, they're really interested in their location. So that's why when you come into the page, it says, where do you want to see information for? And you put in, Ararat, and Ararat brings up all the information for your area, and you work through that. But I understand that people in some cases wanted to look at a whole bunch of towns across Victoria. That is something we'll have to consider and understand how we can best display that in a sort of accessible and logical way.
Whilst all of the feedback's been going on social media, there's been a lot of sharing of the fact the old website, I think you refer to it as a legacy website, is still up there, reg.bomb.gov.au. There's a lot of concern about how long that will stay up there. Do you have a timeline for how long that website will exist for?
Now, at this stage, there's no set date to turn off the legacy website. So we'll gradually continue working on the new website and updating information and moving some of the information across onto the new website. But there's no date to turn off that legacy with the old website.
And I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask this for, but we've heard from the Bureau the cost for this website upgrade was $4.1 million. There's been a lot of reporting, I'm sure you've seen over the weekend, of it being well upwards of 75, even more than $85 million in a website rebuild as well. Do you have any update on that figure that you could share?
No, the figure that we put out publicly that this redesign cost around $4 million, $4.1 million, is accurate. The reporting on the weekend, I'm not sure exactly where they pulled those numbers from, but they're not accurate in terms of the cost of designing this new website for the public.
So you don't know the reasoning for the discrepancy there?
No, I don't understand where they've got those much higher numbers from in the article that came out over the weekend.
General Manager of Environmental Prediction Services at the Bureau of Meteorology, Matt Colopi, speaking to Warwick Long. Weather's up next.
What's complicated, brilliant, and has over 200 years of rollicking backstory? Our Australian electoral system. Join Annabelle Crabb to investigate.
Annabelle Crabb's Civic Duty starts Monday, November 10 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Time to check in on the latest in the weather, and Harry Clark joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Harry.
Good afternoon, Meg.
So what are the watch points for the coming days?
Yeah, so today we really are seeing things settle back down as the trough that's been driving a huge amount of thunderstorm activity and cloud and even areas of rain across the state has now started to shift offshore. So behind it, we are left with mostly clear skies through western Queensland and much of the interior, and a much cooler air mass as well. Currently, temperatures sitting in the mid-20s for most locations, which we think about a week ago, it's up to 20 degrees cooler than last week in some places. So quite a substantial drop in temperature. Also, with the shower and thunderstorm activity, we have seen that really largely contract to pretty much the central Queensland and north Queensland coast this afternoon. So still some isolated showers and thunderstorms possible in those areas, but far less widespread and really not expecting much, if anything, in the way of severe activity today. So I guess the key theme has been finally an easing in our severe thunderstorm activity and weather conditions across the state.
So the storms and rainfall, it sort of not much is expected until the weekend?
Yeah, that's correct. So we do have a lingering chance today, really much, pretty much about the east coast north around Gympie, of some isolated shower and thunderstorm activity during the afternoon. But it will be very hit and miss, so don't expect to see too much out of it. And as we look further ahead, we do see a ridge of high pressure really dominating Queensland into Wednesday and Thursday. And with that, just only the lingering chance of an isolated afternoon shower or thunderstorm, pretty much from St. Lawrence northwards along the coast into the far north and peninsula. But really, once again, very hit and miss. It's not until we look towards Friday that we start to see our next front system approach from the west. So we will see some isolated thunderstorm chances about the southern interior and far southwest channel country on Friday afternoon with that. Potentially some of those could be a little bit gusty as well. Also a little bit of an increase in temperatures ahead of that system. So temperatures returning to near average through the interior or even slightly above average by Friday. And then that system will move across much of the state on the weekend. So through the remainder of the interior on Saturday and into eastern Queensland on Sunday. That'll mean another round of showers and potentially thunderstorms again for much of the state as that system passes through.
I know we're sort of coming into storm season and this is just part of it, but is there anything in particular that's driving this this lot of storms?
Yeah, I guess with the storms we've just had, it's been quite phenomenal in the amount of giant hail we've seen recorded as part of this. And certainly the last, you know, 3-4 days have been very significant in terms of that across southeast and central Queensland. We know we get storms every year, and particularly peaking around this time climatologically. It's our storm season. We're pretty used to it, but It has been sort of quite exceptional, this, particularly the large hail and giant hail that we have seen. It's very hard to pinpoint whether this is just a sort of random chances all occurring in a few days in a row, or whether it's been contributed to by the very warm sea surface temperatures we have off the Queensland coast. So the Coral Sea broadly sitting to around 1 to 1.5 degrees above average at the moment. We do know that increased moisture equals increased energy for our thunderstorms when they do form. So there likely is probably a small proportion of that contributing to this as well. But it's very difficult to say how much is just random chance and how much is a result of that abnormally warm sea surface temperatures in the Coral Sea.
And speaking of coastal areas, anything in particular, how are wind and swells looking?
It looked generally quite light for the next few days. So we do have a very weak ridge of high pressure along the central and northern Queensland coast, and that's generally leading to east-northeasterly winds around 10 to 15 knots. Elsewhere in the south, we've got generally northerly winds today as that trough system moves through. And over the next few days, we do see a southeasterly change start to extend along the southern and central Queensland coast during tomorrow. Only generally, once again, quite light, around 10 to 15 knots, and that will progress to be more broadly southeasterly winds across the entire Queensland coast by Thursday. Once again, not too strong. The exception is probably the Gulf of Carpentaria. We do have a fairly fresh south to southeasterly wind change that's moved through that area and will continue to do so for the remainder of today. So winds up to 20, even 25 knots there at times.
And what's the latest on the severe heat wave in the north?
Yeah, so while we have seen temperatures really dial back throughout much of the state, or will shortly, we do see that sort of cooler change failing to make it all the way into far north Queensland. So we still do have a severe heatwave warning for areas of the North Triple Coast and the peninsula. I mean, typically a very hot time of year, but these temperatures even then are well above average for those locations, broadly about 3 degrees above average. So we use Weeper as an example, generally around 38 or 39 degrees for the next 7 days straight. So probably the key theme is no real respite from the heat in the far north, nor the humidity either, with these continued warm conditions.
Harry, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much.
Harry Clark, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology. Now, local fire bans remain in place for 7 council areas across parts of North Queensland today. So during fire bans, you are not allowed to light any fires in the open, but some exceptions do apply. There are more details about what you can and can't do during a fire ban and a full list of the council areas that have bans in place today at the Queensland Fire Department website, which is fire.qld.gov.au. So I'll just repeat that one. That is fire.qld.gov.au.
The Ashes. And there's cricket
on. Rushes in and bowls it. Yorker and bowls it.
ABC Sports Summer of Cricket on your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thank you for your company. If you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour today, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. I'll take you to far north Queensland now, where the search for solutions continues in Mosman today as the sugar industry tries to find a way forward. So 2 weeks ago, it was announced cane would no longer be sent to the mill at Gordon Vale for crushing, which is about 100 kilometres away, after the Mosman mill closed last year. So a commercial agreement could not be reached between growers and millers struggling with unviable transport costs. Queensland's Primary Industries Minister Tony Perrott spoke to media ahead of a Mosman Advisory Committee meeting.
Agreement between cane growers and MSF didn't materialise, but importantly, the Chris Fuller government will continue to support this community, and I want to hear directly from them today about the future and what they see as the options for primary industry here in this region. We understand the importance of primary industry. This region's been built on primary industry over a long period of time. But circumstances have changed, you know, in recent times, and obviously with the failure of the mill, the issues that have been related to that, of course, we need to look for new solutions, and we're there to back the community in doing that.
So what is the overall goal of this meeting?
Well, look, the purpose is to listen. Obviously, the local member, David Kempton, works closely with this community. We have $6 million of funding that's still on the table. That's essential that we look to the community to look for leads as to how that can be best spent to support the community. But we need to be led by the community, and particularly through local member David Kempton. He understands the issues here, he understands the challenges, but more importantly, I just want to re-emphasise to this community, to the council, the business community, to the primary producers, that we're not walking away. We gave that commitment in the lead-up to the election, and through that, we will continue to stand beside them as we look for future options.
That $6 million, that's still yet to be spent. Is there any idea on where that might go yet?
No, not yet. So that's the purpose of this trip, obviously through the Mossman Advisory Committee and local member David Kempton. We're looking for those leads. Of course, the decision between cane growers and MSF around cane supply agreements didn't work out, and that's only just happened recently. So the first opportunity I've got back here to Mossman, just to make certain that we can listen to the community, listen to those that are involved, and look for options into the future.
You're talking about timing. It didn't work out. I think the last time the Premier was speaking on the issue, he told the farmers, plant, fertilise. We know it costs a lot of money to plant and fertilise. The timing is quite unfortunate. Will some of that money go towards either recouping next year's harvest or...?
That's still to be determined, with respect to the discussions that we'll have here today. Of course, there could be still discussions going on between MSF and cane growers as well, with respect to the way forward. But in respect of what we placed on the table, looking for a broad agreement between them and the support that we're going to provide, obviously that had fallen over. But there's a number of options that are still on the table, and of course we're just here to listen, and that's why the Premier was keen for me to be back here as well, just to again reaffirm our commitment to this community and to listen to what they have to tell us as the way forward. And that's why I look forward to stepping into this meeting here in Mossman again this morning, just to listen to that message.
Is one of those options still trucking cane back to MSF at Gordonville?
Well, certainly not with state government subsidy. Obviously that was something that we were considering, and we placed on the table. However, that required an agreement between cane growers and MSF. That were private negotiations, private discussions that were taking place. Of course, we placed money on the table to be able to give confidence to the process. But of course, that was something that they reached agreement between themselves. And of course, now we've got to look at the way forward and what may be a long term option for this community, and that's what it's about. It's not just the short term. We're looking for long term solutions to primary industry here in this state or in Mossman, sorry. And that's why we just need again to re-emphasise that to the community. I've got the Director General of the Department of Primary Industries here. I've got departmental people that will continue to work with the community on options, and of course we'll continue to support that. But equally, we need to be led by their way forward.
More realistically, with those that have planted cane this year and it'll be due to be harvested next year, what do you realistically see happening with that crop?
Well, that's what I want to hear today from the growers. Obviously, they're the ones that have made that decision in and around that, and I'm not privy to the discussions that they may or may not be having with MSF with respect of what they may be trying to negotiate. And nor should I. That's something that obviously is a private matter for them. But equally, I'm looking for long-term solutions for this community, and that's why I'm confident through this Mossman Advisory Committee that we'll get those. But equally, that's what's needed for this community is long-term options, not short-term.
Is there a feeling that there might not be any answers? Like, there's no mill nearby. The agreement between here and Gordonville's fallen off. There's not many other things you can do with sugarcane.
No. Look, it's challenging, and that's the problem. This community, have relied on sugar for a long period of time, and generally through no fault of the growers or anyone for that matter, it's become unviable for a mill to operate. We all know the many millions of dollars that have been poured into that mill. It failed, and it was something that we've inherited into government. But of course, the commitment that we've made is we're here to support this community. We understand the importance of primary industry to this region, but equally we need to be guided by the community because they're the people on the ground. I don't pretend it's going to be easy, but equally we're not stepping away, and that's the message that I want to deliver today.
Queensland's Primary Industries Minister Tony Perrott speaking in Mossman this morning. It is 11 minutes to one.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
The family of an American man killed in a 2023 plane crash in outback Queensland say they're still seeking justice 2 years on from the tragedy. 22-year-old Long Island resident William Jennings was a camera operator on a bushfire surveillance plane that crashed near Cloncurry on the 4th of November in 2023. He and two others died in what the Australian Transport Safety Bureau found was an entirely preventable crash. Toby Loftus has this story.
That day, November 4th, 2023, our life just changed in an instant. And, this 2 years has just, it seems like almost yesterday, unfortunately.
That's Joseph Jennings, the father of William Jennings, speaking from his home in Long Island, New York. He and wife Denise are still in shock after their son died in a tragic plane crash 2 years ago.
He was so loving. He was the best son ever. He just brought so much joy into our lives, and he was so intelligent. He was so funny and caring.
The firefighting surveillance plane, owned by Victorian company Ag Air and doing contract work for Queensland's fire department, was flying from Toowoomba in the state's south to Mount Isa in the north to survey fire zones when it crashed near Cloncurry. On board was a pilot who had suffered from hypoxia or a lack of oxygen to the brain in the lead up to the crash. There were also two camera operators on board, including Will. All three died in the crash.
It was so tough to lose, you know, your son, but he was also my best friend. And just, it's very difficult.
His many friends are devastated. People are just still reeling from the final report that it should have never happened. It was just preventable up until the very last moment.
Will had graduated from Northeastern University with a mechanical engineering degree a few months earlier and had been working with thermal cameras, which got him the short-term job on that fateful flight.
Will was excited to go to Australia. He had never left the country before, so he wanted to see Australia, and he was excited to use the camera he worked on and wanted to help out. Too. He wanted to help Australia during these fires because he had seen the devastation that these fires had caused, destroying property and lives and the wildlife that had really made an impression on him. So he was excited to be able to help.
He was in the country just 11 days when the tragedy struck.
I can remember the night before the crash, we were talking, he was talking about going up to the Gold Coast and try to learn how to surf and everything too. So it's just, it's just so devastating. That was one of our last conversations was, talking about surfing on the Gold Coast, and he just never got there.
In June, the Australian Transport Safety Bureau found the crash was entirely preventable and was caused by a well-known, long-standing pressurisation defect with the aircraft. Just before the crash, AgAir operators did not pass information during a phone call to air traffic controllers about the pressurisation defect. Controllers raised with AgAir they had lost contact with the plane and had concern the pilot may have been suffering from a lack of oxygen.
That part just really hurts me more than anything, that crucial information was not passed on.
They had plenty of time to save them had that information been shared. And that's the real tragedy behind it.
I was physically sick. It made me sick. It made me sad. It made me angry. I was just devastated by it.
Now, 2 years on, the Jennings family wants answers and justice. The Civil Aviation Safety Authority is investigating the crash, but they believe workplace health and safety regulators should also be investigating.
I just don't understand, because the contributing factors that led to the crash, they were created on the ground at the workplace that is AgAir. So I just really have a hard time understanding why WorkSafe hasn't initiated an investigation since the release of the final report. If they're aim is to deter non-compliance that leads to death, then they need to do an investigation and they need to bring forth a prosecution.
WorkSafe Queensland and WorkSafe Victoria were contacted for comment. For the Jennings family, they say they'll keep going until they get justice.
We do the best we can. We're trying to honour our son and make sure, you know, that in the end, you know, that this thing is really looked at and the people that, you know, might have caused it, you know, face justice.
Joseph Jennings ending that report from Toby Loftus. Now, before I take you to markets, I just want to bring you an update on some of today's news. So Liberal Senator Jane Hume says it is profoundly important for her party to represent more than just rural Australia as it considers its commitment to net zero emissions. So the coalition met for its joint party room session today for the first time since the Nationals abandoned reaching net zero emissions by 2050. Senator Hume says the leader of the opposition, Susan Lee, needs to take a position on energy policy as a matter of urgency.
It's also profoundly important, though, for Liberals to represent all Australians, not just a sectional interest, not just regional and rural Australia. And that's exactly what the Liberal Party intends to do.
So the other big story that's happening today is interest rates. Mortgage holders are widely expected to miss out on a Melbourne Cup Day interest rate cut when the Reserve Bank announces its decision this afternoon. Glenn Lauder reports.
The likelihood of a November rate cut was as high as 81% a fortnight ago, but the chances have slumped to just 7% amid higher than expected inflation data. CPI surged from 2.1% to 3.2% in the September quarter, and the RBA's preferred measure of trimmed mean inflation is also now at the high end of the board's target range. Fiona Clark from CVS Lane Capital Partners says Governor Michelle Bullock's post-meeting briefing could give us an insight into whether rates may drop in December or February.
That might give us something to get excited about.
Rates have already been cut three times this year, from 4.35% to 3.6%.
Let's cross to the Roma store sale with David Friend.
With some wonderful and much-needed storm rain in the Marinara and the surrounding supply district, Roma agents yarded 5,313 head. All the regular buyers attended, the market stronger for the better lines. At the time of this interim report, yearling steers 200 to 80 kilos, topping at 5.52 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos, selling from $3 to 5.22 cents a kilo to restockers. Yearling steers 330 to 400 kilos made to $5 to average 482 to also to restockers. Yearling steers 440 kilos sold from 440 to 492 to lot feeders. Growing steers 400 to 500 kilos selling to 376 cents a kilo to lot feeders. Growing steers 500 to 600 kilos sold to 446 to processors. Growing steers over 600 kilos to 428 to processors. Bulls 450 to 600 kilos to 384. And bulls over 600 kilos to 396 cents a kilo. This has been David Fenn from the National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
Now, Errol Luck is watching the prices at the Warwick sale yards today.
Good afternoon. Supply of stock at Warwick increased by 500 head to 1,407. All the regular buyers attended and operate on a dearer market for all classes. Yearling cattle to restockers and to feed sold at dearer trends, with bullocks to processors up from 2 to 16. Lightweight and medium weight cows to processors lifted from 20 to 30 cents, with the heavy cows firm. At the time of this interim report, lightweight yearling steers to restockers sold to 526. Yearling steers over 280 to background sold to 508, with those to feed at 498. Yearling steers to feed the domestic market made to 494. Heavy yearling steers to feed made to 490 and averaged from 451 to 472. Yearling heifers in the 200 to 80 range to background sold to 420. And medium weight heifers to feed sold to 442. And heavy yearling heifers to wholesale meat trade made 448. Brooks to processors sold to 450 and averaged from 430 to 438. Lightweight cows, plain condition cows to restockers sold to 348, with those to processors at 361. Heavy score 3 cows to processors made 388 to average 372. The best of heavy cows topping at 405 and averaging 386. This is Errol Luck, MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Well, that's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. If you want to get more rural news, you can head online to the ABC Rural website, abc.net.au/rural. News is coming up next. It's 1 o'clock.